Well, thank you very much for staying for the panel discussion. We're going to keep this very informal, but let me introduce the panel members. Firstly, Anita Dockley, who's Research Director at the Howard League for Penal Reform, and we've worked with Anita in the past on various policy events, and we're delighted that she could come along this afternoon. And then Genevieve Say, who of course was in the performance and can perhaps reflect on how it was to be part of the cast and to work with this particular kind of material. And then Catherine Cox, who's based at UCD, and myself, Hilary Marland, who's based at the University of Warwick. We are co-directors of a project on prisoners, medicine and entitlement to health in England and Ireland between 1850 and 2000. And the play was based on some of the research we've done as part of that project. Just to start us off, I wonder if Catherine could expand a little bit on that research process and how we made those connections with Talking Birds and how we collaborated to produce the script with the director, Peter Kahn, who alas can't be here this afternoon.
So I guess I'm being Pete for the moment.
You're being Pete.
On the questions and answers, not on the artistic input. Well, the way we worked on the process, just to go through it briefly, Hilary and I suppose for a year collected various research materials from prisons in both England and Ireland, but principally from Pentonville here in London, Liverpool, Mountjoy Prison in Dublin. We did about a year's research of pulling together material from the 1850s around the question of the introduction of the separate system and the impact it had on the prisoners themselves and the minds in particular of the prisoners. And having gone through that research, we then handed huge amounts over to Pete. And Pete has an amazing ability to distill information and to really pull out key themes. Themes, you know, sort of hand research to your students and they pick up totally different themes. But Pete, you know, pulled out really, really strong trends, and trends I thought we were comfortable with as well, that we had thought were in the material as well. But he does this in his own independent way. He comes back with very precise, clear questions, often very thought-provoking questions. But he also then brings his own interpretation to that material. So Pete then does the process of writing a script, shares it with us. We chip in. He may not want to hear our chips sometimes. Sometimes he's, but on the whole, he's very, very receptive. So that's, I suppose, the starting point process. And after that, of course, we already, or rather, Hilary initially had the relationship with Talking Birds from the first play that she did with them. And Disorder Contained is part of a trilogy. So the first play was A Trade in Madness.
Lunacy.
Lunacy, sorry. I don't need to know the title. That's not mine. A Trade in Lunacy, which she worked with Pete and Talking Birds, I think it was 2013. And that played in Coventry, in the Absolute Theatre. And then coming from that, then myself and Hilary collaborated with Pete and Talking Birds on another play, which was Malady and Migration, and that played in Coventry in Dublin. And then we have the third play, which has played now in Coventry, Dublin, Belfast, and now London. So I think that's the whistle-top story of the process.
That was great. And Jen, what was it like to work with this kind of material? Because it must have been quite different, perhaps, to work with a script that's based on historical research and a particular kind of historical research.
Yeah, well, a lot of the work that I've done has been devised. And the script and the story has come about within the making process. And sometimes we haven't even got a script, you know, when we go into the rehearsal room. So, you know, all that's coming from a completely different place than actual historical resources. So for me, it was really interesting to have that real firm background of information that we could draw on, that we could pull on. And there was so much, there was such a wealth of stuff. And as the actors, we didn't have the job of like taking the piles of information and distilling it down like the director did, so that was quite nice. But we still had the job of taking that quite, and what can be sometimes quite dry, you know, information about people and turning it back into something that's about emotion and human experience, and layered in with characterization, so that as an audience you can hopefully connect to the characters, or you know, have some sort of emotional response to their experience. So it's quite an interesting journey from the point where we get the script and we've got not much really to go on in terms of characterization, and get to something that still feels true to the information that you've passed on and given us, that that still houses all that really important stuff, but is also theatrical and something that we can attach to and respond to in a human way.
So I wonder if we could open up to questions from the audience. And if Flo has a mic, and the mic won't enhance your volume, it's for recording purposes because we're live streaming this.
I did really enjoy it, the performance. Thank you. Maybe this is a question for Hilary and for Catherine, but I was just quite interested in terms of why you chose particularly the those prisons, the actual resources from those prisons. Was there any reason why you chose Pentonville and I can't remember the other two?
It's partly self-selection. We used to work on the history of asylums, in particularly 19th century mental hospitals, and there you're swimming in material. It's astonishing how much has been kept. So we have complete runs of case books, we have annual reports, masses, absolutely incredible. When we came to prisons, we got a little bit of a shock. There are archives, but they tend to be much more scanty. So we found one chaplain's notebook at Pentonville. We found lots of medical records, but they're often embedded in minutes and other administrative records. We have some memoirs which were written by prisoners, and also a lot of official documentation.
And the school teacher's journal.
So it was in a way partly self-selection, and the best records probably in England were Pentonville. Liverpool has good records, Reading has some, and Mountjoy has extremely good records. So it was partly choosing institutions of some significance, and Pentonville was the place where separate confinement was first introduced in England, and then it moved on to Mountjoy Prison in 1850. So those in a way were the two, if you like, key sites in some ways for introducing this experiment into these two England and Ireland.
And I suppose we're interested as well in that, you know, how an idea, this sort of experiment, you know, it's played out, you know, but there's clearly negative results from it, and yet it becomes very resilient, and it, you know, becomes really embedded in the system, and it's used, and yes, it's adjusted and modified as it moves to different places, but the sort of support for it continues well into the late 19th, into the early 20th century. So that's really quite intriguing how that can, something can remain so embedded.
I just wanted, I know you touched a bit on the fact that what your interests were, why you looked into that. I just wanted to find out, was the possibly the rates in like mental health alongside with suicidal, was the rates high?
Historically, it's quite hard to get those figures. I mean, suicide rates, I think, only become really available from the 1970s-ish.
Yeah, that's right.
It's, you know, so we are sort of quite frustrated with that. It's also quite hard to attempt to figure out what the actual rates, the percentage of prisoners suffering from mental illness. Some contemporary figures were given which pointed out time and again it was much higher than in the general population. But I think it's only in recent times that Anita will be able to tell us, you know, that you get a clearer picture of the actual figures for mental illness within the prison system.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at things like suicide and self-harm, there's only been a real emphasis and monitoring of them, as Hilary said, since the 1970s. And there was early work about safer custody from the 1980s onwards. Last year, we saw more deaths in the prison system than we had on record ever before. And the trend is the same this year. you hear from the chief inspector and those that go into prison about the levels of harm in prison, not just self-harm, but prisoner on prisoner and prisoner on staff, assault levels. Prisons are violent places. And I think the containment that you saw in the prisons in the 19th century that were being depicted there, it's violence in a different way against the person in some ways. You can see it's a violent institution in the way it was how they contain people and how that can be seen as violence. Violence plays out in very in different ways. Yet we do still have a semblance of that separate system because we have segregation units, we have children isolated as well in cells for long periods of time. And there's a deeper custody sections in prisons where there are units which are closed supervision units, which are even segregation exacerbated, let's put that around the... So we still have semblances of what was being depicted in our system today. And the violence levels, as seen through self-harm, are high. It's a highly toxic... We hear about it in the news today from the Prison Governors Association about how they're full to capacity, and they're struggling to cope with the prisoners, with the numbers of staff and prisoner ratios, which are so important for mental health. And yet, so it's not a system that's evolved to, I wouldn't argue it's evolved to a better place. It's just a different way of being quite a violent, possibly harmful in some instances to those that are in it, as well as having the ideal of actually changing and being a rehabilitative place. And I think that's quite a hard act to try and pull off. How you do that, it's quite difficult. And I think that's a challenge that we haven't got to grips with adequately. Doing it slightly differently for the majority, but I don't know whether we're doing it better.
And I think another huge shift is the question of what was happening to mentally ill people in prison, because there was the scope in the 19th century to move prisoners to the large asylums, the mental hospitals. But prisons were often quite reluctant to do that because it was like admitting defeat, if you like. You know, the system would then be seen as failing. So there's a lot of effort to mask mental illness in the prison or to blame it on the prisoners, to say, well, it's not the system that made them mentally ill. It's not separate confinement. They actually came into prison mentally weak. So that's kind of interesting to think about the contrast with today, where we know there are many mentally ill people in the criminal justice system, but the problem is there's not many other places for them to go. Is that right, Anita?
I think that's right, yeah. I mean, I think some of you are studying criminology, am I right? Yeah. I think you see, when you look at the statistics, vast swathes of the population have some sort of mental illness, whether it's diagnosable or not. They're recognised to have mental health issues in the prison when they go in and while they're there. And I think there's also what we saw in the play, that mental health deteriorates because of the system that they're in as well. And I think that's a very hard thing to tease out about what, you know, chicken and egg, what came first, were there issues prior to or not, and what is it just the environment they're held in, and it's a coping strategy in dealing with things. So I think that's quite interesting. But I also think it's not easy, and I don't know whether it's the right thing to move people onto mental health institutions either. The fact that came out in the play that somebody then spent the rest of their life there. For some prisoners, you could argue, with mental health issues, transfer to a mental health institution prolongs their time in an institution. Mm. It's harder to get out of a mental health institution than it is at the end of a determinate sentence. And I think the ideal that we want for people who end up in our penal institutions is that they can come out and lead a good and useful life and be a part of our communities again. And so I just think about the way we deal with people, the way in the institutions and then moving on to the outside is really, really important. And whether mental health institutions are always the right places to go, I think the answer's in the balance.
And in Ireland, actually, in Clover Hill prison, they've introduced a system there where they have prisoners on remand and they're trying to assess them at that moment and provide the mental health services then, and basically move them out of the prison system and into the health system so they don't get sucked into that institutional environment and then moving on into another institutional. So to remove them at that stage and identify people who need support at a much earlier stage.
So just another quick question. So just looking at the play that we watched today with the three different ladies that played a part, some of them, or one or two of them, you could actually say, was it mental health or was it a personality disorder? So because sometimes there is a difference between the two. So who would you class as strictly diagnosed them as a mental health, and what would you look at to say, you know, that's close enough to being a personality disorder, if you understand?
But yeah, you should start.
I suppose generally just the classification in this period, we're looking at the 1850s, really in the play. The classification of mental health in this period was very, you know, just generally mania, melancholia, those basic. But within the prison itself, they seem to develop a certain amount of their own categories, essentially, where they would talk about certain behaviours, delusions, as we saw during the play. They would use certain labelling that maybe you wouldn't see being used in the 19th century lunatic asylums, like sullen, eccentric,
irritable.
Those type of languages. So that's really the categories that we have to draw from, the language that's used by the prison doctors themselves in this period. So you don't really get this division, as you know, we're more familiar with today, of personality disorder and mental illness as such.
Can I just say as well, that just the character that I played, who was the youngest and actually the only one who comes out of it sort of fine, really, without any sort of mental health issues, uses his imagination, and which veers into hallucination and delusion as a coping mechanism to get through that quite extreme time period, you know, in that setting. And so there's a sense of there's a line, isn't there, that mm-hmm. it sort of wavers like this, where you, to a certain extent, my character was in control. He was in control of mentally what he was experiencing, but he was still going to the far edges of what that was, so that he could sort of keep handle on the solitary confinement.
I'm also interested in the present. Is there any experimentation with regards to different kinds of prisons?
I mean, our prison system has various different types of institution within it. If you first go into a prison, you're going to what's a local prison. Pentonville is still at work, mm-hmm. operating today. So people who are awaiting trial, or just been sentenced, or seven relatively short sentences, will tend to be held there. And they're not actually doing very much within them. They're basically tending to people's needs as they come into the system. If you're in for a longer time, you go on to what's called a training prison. Or if you're sentenced to a long time, it could be a category A. And there are more things that go on in terms of trying to enable people to rehabilitate, deal with their issues to do with their offending, and hopefully find ways, pathways out to reintegrate back into the community. Now, there are things there that go on in terms of work, education, and offending behaviour courses. There's one prison, Grendon, that has a therapeutic community, and there are others dotted around, but that's the well-known one. So that's a different model for trying to engage with people, seen as very successful. But one of the pitfalls of it is very rarely do people who work in the therapeutic community get released from that prison. They have to go back into the mainstream system where it doesn't have that same environment to actually try and deal with issues and work through them in a more therapeutic way before they leave. I think there are issues also, it's touched on in the play, about the importance of your networks and social ties and reintegrating back in and the family. prisons are not always, you're not always in the prisons closest to your family and closest to home. So therefore there are issues there about, you know, there are discussions about whether going back to a home area is always productive, but for a vast majority it is. And it's those social bonds that are so important to keep people on that journey to that good and useful life, you know. So, I mean, there are different ways of doing it here, and there are, not every prison is the same. And of course there are open prisons as well, where people coming to the end of their sentences have chance to spend time in the community on temporary release, maybe try volunteering or doing work and or going to college, and gradually building up the set of skills needed after a long sentence in particular to actually manage. I did some work a few years ago on women lifers, and talking to them, it's the simple things that get taken away from you that you need to help with. I mean, all the different technologies, the speed of the traffic, and all those sorts of things that we in daily life take for granted, those sort of deprivations that you just don't think about, you just take for granted in life. So those types of prisons are there, and importantly there, and do lots of good work. But whether there are any models that I would say actually are positive, and whether they need to be quite so many, because if you think about who, because I think one of the themes for me that came up was the characterisation to the three characters and why they were there and the type of life backgrounds they came from. Really, you could probably be talking about a vast majority of a churn of about 86,000 people going in prison today. The churn of those are serving quite short sentences for relatively minor, non-violent offences. As the prison governor said, those serving 12 months and under today, should they be in a prison? And I think that was some of the, to me, it made me smile at the very beginning. I'm seeing the same characters that I would see if I'm thinking about contemporary prisons today. And I think that's pretty sad that we've not moved on and not thought more creatively about whether this institution is the one that's going to make the difference. So there are different types of institutions that try to do different things. Often people look to Scandinavia for better, different types of institution. There are issues with them. Culturally, it's seen very differently. Prison is a place of punishment. The welfare systems do the other stuff. So their sentences are shorter, even for what we sort of think of as quite serious crimes. So that's a very different take on it. I have issues with the fact that they queue up to go to prison. If somebody needs to go to prison, it's already needed now, not that you have to wait your turn. So they do that for some people. So I don't say it's perfect, but I do think there's a lot to be said for having a better social policy system and welfare systems, because prison should be a place of last resort.
Yes, I work for the prisoners' newspaper Inside Time, and I've spent this year working with the MOJ and other people looking at keeping safe. And I think one thing we saw from the play that came across really strongly was the problem with isolation and mental illness. And one of the things that people probably don't realise who aren't into prisons is that there are a number of incentive levels within prisons. So you've got basic, which is nothing at all. You don't come out of your cell. You get very few visits. You've got no TV, no radio. With the current system, you probably won't get to the library. That's if you can read. And the way the system works is that if people are seen to be behaving badly, they then get put onto the basic regime. Now, the people who are behaving badly are very often behaving badly because they've got mental health issues. So then, having mental health issues, they are then put on the basic regime, which is exactly the opposite of what they need. So they then go into isolation. They've got nothing to do all day, no TV to watch, no radio, very few family visits. And one thing that we did, we said to prisoners, because there's lots of experts say, we know why people hurt themselves, we know why people kill themselves. So we actually said, let's ask the prisoners. And we got hundreds of responses, very, very well thought out. And there were some very, very simple issues that came up, which was, again, with the incentive scheme, that contact with families is so important. And one thing that I argue is that visits for children you know, they'll stop a father seeing his children because he's been naughty, which may be because he's got mental health issues. But doesn't his children have rights to see the father? So what is happening is, in my personal opinion, I'm not speaking for the newspaper now, is that the prisons are doing things exactly the opposite way round. So if people have got mental health issues, they do exactly what we saw in the play and isolate people. So those mental health issues get worse, when maybe what they should be doing is the opposite. And what a lot of the prisoners said was that when they're feeling depressed, when they're feeling suicidal, it would be wonderful if families could be involved. So they're actually getting support from the families. So you don't need a lot of medical doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists. They just need more people around them to support them. And I think it really came across to me in the play, having spoken to a lot of prisoners and obviously been talking about this for a year now, the problem with isolation. And I think that is something that hopefully, because the ministers have got copies of our report now and people are acting on it, that maybe something will be done, and the mental health issues of the isolation in prison. I mean, a lot of prisoners now are locked up 22, 23 hours a day. And if you can imagine in a room the size of probably most people's toilet at home, just imagine no TV, no radio, nothing to do, nothing to read, and you're in there all the time, possibly on your own.
Well, the resonances are so strong. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned books, and the withdrawal of books, as you know, in the play, is referred to again and again, particularly by educated prisoners who are writing their memoirs, who have talked about this consistently.
Well, of course, Grayling, he tried to stop prisoners having books.
Yeah.
And the Howard League were right up front with that. We had Rachel Billington from our newspaper who was joining you, and we were fighting because the importance of books.
But and that incentivization, that of course, you know, that has 19th century roots. That was sort of introduced into prisons, brought in, of course, from Norfolk Island, famously known as well as the Irish system, because Crofton experimented with it in Mountjoy. So this idea that if you move towards work and if you perform in a particular way, that certain things are eased. But of course, as you say, the flip side is that is if you don't perform, if you don't behave, you're demoted back down the system, and it's those that are least able to perform in that environment that tends to be knocked down. I mean, all those, I suppose, there are a lot of resonances there with the story.
I think the message we got is the stick doesn't work. Encouragement, it really, really works. A lot of people really respond to encouragement. The recent thing of always calling prisoners offenders, you're an offender, you're an ex-offender, it almost puts a mindset into them, and it stops that rehabilitation. I mean, you mentioned the courses, offender behaviour courses. There's a report just been shown that a lot of the courses actually make people more likely to re-offend than people who don't do the courses. So it really does need looking at. Thank you.
You say in your notes that the chaplain was the chief advocate of the separate system, and that came over very, very powerfully in the play. So could you say a bit more about the role of the church in the system in general? And can I have a second question, which is a very simple yes-no question? No, the second one's a very simple one. Did this system affect men and women as well?
Yeah, it's the chaplain is really the force. Well, much of the force behind the introduction, it was seen as very much a spiritual, a system of reform. They were very influential in bringing it over from the United States, and very forceful, actually, in bringing it into Pentonville. There was some debate about whether this was the best system to adopt. And the chaplains really did make the running in both pushing this through. And, I mean, that's the interesting thing about it. It's very much in the 1840s and 50s when it's introduced, it is very much thought of as being reformative, that this somehow this isolation, this opportunity to reflect in the quiet of the cell would somehow enable you to reflect on your crimes and to repent, and in conversations with the chaplain, which were, the chaplain made many, many cell visitations in the prison. And in a way, the doctor was
demoted
a little bit. I mean, chaplains are even paid more in the English system. And I think the story is a little bit different in Ireland, where they're actually
When they bring it to Mountjoy, there's a concern, of course, because that chaplains having this one-on-one contact, if it was a Church of Ireland chaplain and the prisoner was Catholic, there'd be attempts for conversionism. So there's a bit of a sort of scramble about that. So the role of the chaplain is sort of demoted a bit. He's more on a level, as it were, with the school teacher, but he's not really allowed to interfere with the school teacher and interfere with the curriculum, because that's another environment where conversion can take place. So you have a sort of a bit of concern over the chaplain when he moves into the Irish context, and also the type of reading that the chaplain provides, because of course some of the Presbyterian chaplains would provide quite robust treaties for their prisoners to read, that then when the prisoner went into association, they would talk about to their Catholic fellow prisoners. And so there was sort of this concern that there would be tension between the prisoners because of the tracts that were being provided. So it gets a bit messy when you move it in, as religion tends to, when you move it into Ireland. But they're still very significant figures in the 1850s and into the 60s, yeah.
And the first chaplain at Pentonville actually was forced to resign because it was thought his overzealous preaching was really driving the prisoners into insanity. So there were numerous cases of religious mania were actually reported. And he was sort of forced out in the end. And then women. Yeah, women were also subjected to the system, but generally for shorter periods, because they were seen as less equipped to cope with this long stretches of solitude and
fragile women.
And so sometimes it was a much reduced period of separate confinement. But interestingly enough, women provide us with some of the best memoirs when they were reporting on this experience and saying how terrible it was for themselves and for other prisoners. But generally, I can't say it anymore, the period was much shorter for women.
Yeah.
So I think we'll wrap up now, Derek. But we're all still around if you want to chat, talk about a bit more, ask any more questions, then you're very, very welcome.
That's good. Yeah.